KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Jose.
19th Avenue, San Francisco.
San Mateo.
Excelsior District of San Francisco.
Financial District.
Coming up, we learn about how a network of East Bay women cope with the fear of deportation.
Latino women help each other, let's say. So by helping others, they help themselves.
Then we'll hear how a South Bay musician found his way to the blues.
I think I'm just probably just genetically designed to be moved by that music. Maybe not so much other people, but I love it.
And we'll hear how members of the Bay Area's Samoan community use church to keep their heritage alive.
Samoan culture is very special to us, very precious. We have to keep that identity that we have, our Samoan identity.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. President Trump yesterday called for an end to due process rights for immigrants who enter the country illegally. It comes after last week's flurry of reports that thousands of families have been separated at the southern U.S. border. What does it mean for undocumented families here in the Bay Area? According to ICE statistics, the agency's San Francisco office, which covers all of Northern California, it deported over 6,000 people in the fiscal year 2017. Freelance reporter Alicia Medina Segura says that despite local sanctuary laws, the threat of deportation is still very real. Alicia joined Hana Baba here in studio to talk about her story for the East Bay Express called Coping with the Fear of Deportation. First, Hana asked Alicia about Maria, one of the women featured in the article. When ICE detained Maria's husband, Alicia says it was a stranger named Etel Calles, a volunteer with the Immigrant Family Defense Fund, who came to Maria's rescue.
Maria's story, I guess, is one of the many stories that you can find of migrants that are under the fear of deportation. She was on the kitchen one morning, and she said goodbye to her husband that goes to work in the construction site. And she looks through the window and sees ICE officers handcuffing the husband. And then it was all very quick. She had to go to the school, and then she meets Ethel. And Ethel, right away, because of she is part of the Family Defense Fund, she goes to the immigration offices in San Francisco to pay the bond. Mm-hmm. And that's why Maria's husband was able to sleep on his house that night. And
because Ethel helped.
Because Ethel was able to go to the office and pay the bond, and it was released. So what I found is that there are many organizations here that help migrants, but basically it's legal stuff. Mm-hmm. Like they will help. What to do if ICE goes to your place? What to do if you find an officer? But what about the next day? What about the psychological effects? So it's like women are the ones that are holding up the community, and they are taking care of themselves and of their children and of their family altogether. So that was one of, a
surprise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so who are these women? Like, they are usually like women, neighbors, moms, daughters, sisters.
So what about children? You said these are all, just women. A lot of them are moms. A lot of parents, live under this threat of being deported. Do you know how either the women or the schools are talking to children about, what if mama's deported? What if daddy's deported?
Mm-hmm. Vilma is a teacher in Merrill's Leadership Academy as well. And
In Oakland,
yeah. And when she was 3 years old, her father was deported. And she has lived a life with an absent father. They didn't talk at all for 25 years. They didn't have a relationship, let's say. So she knows the struggle about deportation and what deportation can mean. The beautiful thing here is that when she was a child, she met this teacher, Mrs. White, that really helped her and took care of her and made her feel like valuable. So now she's a teacher, and she's kind of giving back what she received. Mm-hmm. And because she's a Latina woman, her students find her like more approachable. So, it's not like a white woman that maybe you think that, oh, she might not understand.
Right.
She understands because she has been through the same experience that you as an 8-year-old or as a 10-year-old are experiencing.
So it sounds like a lot of these women who are helping also have had experience with deportation.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Did you feel these women were prepared for deportation at any moment?
You mean if they have like a luggage?
How do you deal with that?
Under the
not
bed?
Just luggage. Yeah, I mean, luggage, plans, kids, where do they go? Is there, like, a lot of us have earthquake plans. Uh-huh. A lot of us have disaster plans. Are there people who actually make plans in terms of, you know, if daddy leaves, there's the auntie over there that you call her. And, you know, is it to that extent?
Yeah, there is this document, the family preparedness plan, and they have to put, like, for example, who is the doctor of the kid? Where is the school? Who is going to pick him up? What other family, or if the family is also undocumented, what other friends are going to be there?
What surprised you the most in your reporting?
I guess the strength of the woman, but yeah, how they keep going and among themselves, they just know how to deal with it. Like, oh, I'm afraid to come to school today, so don't worry, I will take your children. You know, they carpool and all these little things that make stories very sad, but also empowering.
That's reporter Alicia Medina Segura speaking with KALW's Hana Baba. Find a link to Alicia's story in the East Bay Express at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. South Bay bluesman Aki Kumar started his musical career after taking harmonica lessons at the School of Blues in San Jose. He built up his music cred playing show after show at blues joints all around the Bay. Eventually, he became so busy with gigs, he quit his day job as a software engineer to do music full-time. On this edition of Bay Area Beats, we'll hear the backstory behind Aki's musical roots in both Bollywood and down-home blues.
I had a harmonica in India. It was not the kind that I play now. It was what they call a tremolo harmonica. It's a cheap harmonica. I think it was a Chinese brand called Hero, which dominated the Indian market then. And it wasn't because we were harmonica players or I knew harmonica players. Almost every family has a harmonica. Somehow it makes its way into the house and it just stays there for generations. So this was my dad's harmonica. And he would try to play on it and I tried to play it. And I figured, okay, this is a limited instrument. You can play some chords on it. Half the notes are missing. It's pointless, whatever. I come over here, I listen to blues, listen to guys like Little Walter. And I go, this is not the same instrument. I grew up in Mumbai, India. It was Bombay back then. And some of my earliest musical memories are music that my dad used to play. Classical music, pop, Indian Hindustani music. That's really what I remember growing up listening to. My mom was one of those singing moms. She would like to sing. And so singing was part of the family tradition. My dad wasn't much of a singer, but he was a whistler, and he whistled. So melodies were always in the air, you know, in my house. But we weren't musicians, and I never considered myself to be a musician. I just loved the lyricism of certain songs and melodies and harmonies, especially in my late teens or, you know, whatever, I was 16 or 17, I'd kind of figured I liked rock and roll older rock and roll. Not that I had a lot of money to buy records or access that kind of music in India, but anytime I came across it, I knew I liked it. Listening to Western music, I'd come across harmonies which weren't that prevalent in Indian music. My ears would go, oh, this is something new. There's this one song, Cecilia. I was trying to break this down and figure out how to sing both parts. And at some point, I might have made a really lame effort, attempt at recording my own version of it. But that, yeah, that was probably my first effort at, you know, getting harmonies together. When I moved to the U.S., I was trying to, you know, just find my place and find my way around. And that meant culturally, too. And one of the cool things that happened to me in the U.S. is I found these oldies radio stations, which at the time in the late 90s, they were playing 50s music. Now they play disco, but it was 50s music, and it was great music, and I really latched onto that. Sweet little girl. A few years later, when I got out of college and, you know, had a job and I was still listening to music, that kind of got me going in the direction of blues, because that's blues influenced pretty much all of American pop music that came out, you know, that was being played at the time. I remember moments when I listened to a great Muddy Waters song and it was late, like 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. And it actually moves you in some way, and you can't identify what it is. Is it the voice? Is it what he's saying? Is it the tone of the guitar? Because it's not intricate, it's just tremendously soulful, spiritual.
You can't spend what you ain't got. Can't lose what you ain't never had.
I think I'm just probably just genetically designed to be moved by that music. Maybe not so much other people, but I love it. I had made an early attempt at this Bollywood blues in my debut blues album. Based on that, I said, why not try this with a few more songs? This song is really popular in India, or at least people will recognize it. You know, you'll get a taste of some of the heavy American swing and jazz influence on Indian music in the 50s. And it was a natural pick for me because it swung hard already. We just said, let's take this and make this really awesomely swinging live. And the cool part about the lyrics of that song, Ina Mina Dika, Deida Damanika, all that stuff is just gibberish. You know, it's like Louis Prima, just scatting, you know. And this is one of the few rare examples of that happening in Indian contemporary music of the time. So I really love this song, and it's a hit when I do it live. People just love it. I wrote this song going to Bombay around the time when a certain presidential candidate berated Mexican immigrants. I'm not a Mexican immigrant, but I am an immigrant, and I understand how it would have made them feel. And I decided to write something about the immigrant experience, kind of because of that. And one of the things about being an immigrant is no matter how well or how long you've assimilated into the new culture or your new home, you have a sense of nostalgia about your old home. And especially for me, because I moved here when I was 18, so my ties are very rooted in India in that sense. And I thought about writing that. So going back to Bombay is a sense of feeling like you want to be home sometimes. Not all the time, but sometimes. Gone back home to it, where pretty women run. I had a desire to represent my Indian musical roots in some way. I hadn't had the musical insight or that aha moment. I didn't have that for a long time because I was so diligently pursuing this traditional blues sound for good reason. I loved it. I wanted to play in that vein. I wanted to be considered an artist that was representing that tradition, even though I was kind of an outsider culturally. So I spent so much time doing that that I almost for a while forgot about, you know, my roots. I was trying to cater to a culture in the blues where I was trying to be the ideal entrant into the blues scene, you know, and that meant being more American. And somewhere along 2014, 2015, and with this whole changing political landscape, I had the realization that it was more important to represent myself through the music than to fit into a particular musical template.
That's South Bay bluesman Aki Kumar. You can catch him playing a weekly blues jam tomorrow night at the Poorhouse Bistro in San Jose. For more details, visit kalw.org. That story was produced by Jackie Sajiko and Jen Chien. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hanna Baba. There are the 50 United States of America, of course, but did you know there are also 14 U.S. territories in the Caribbean and Pacific Islands? One of those is American Samoa. U.S. missionaries and the military arrived there in the 1800s, and by the turn of the century, the island became a U.S. territory. It was divided from its independent counterpart, the nation of Samoa. Now, more than 13,000 people of Samoan ancestry live in the Bay Area. KALW's Sarah Harrison brings us a story about how local Samoans are working to keep their island traditions alive here.
How do many Samoans living in the Bay Area connect to their island heritage? They go to church.
That's how the culture survives outside of Samoa.
Tai Fa'aleava was born in Samoa, but moved to New Zealand and then to the U.S. by the time he was in high school. Both island nations suffer from slow economies, so there are a lot of people like Tai. Now, more Samoans live abroad than live on the islands. Traditionally, Samoan communities are tight-knit and centered around villages with chiefs. For those living abroad, Fa'aleava says the church mimics that structure.
The structure, the relationship between people, also the interaction, the hierarchy that's within the church, I think that's parallel to the Samoan culture. So it's kind of duplicated, I would say.
Missionaries from Europe and the U.S. introduced Christianity to the Samoan Islands starting in the early 1800s. Now, 98% of the population there identify as Christian. Last year, the nation of Samoa even changed its constitution to officially make the country a Christian state. Because Christianity is such a big part of Samoan life, it's not surprising that Samoan communities abroad are turning to churches to help preserve their culture.
The Samoan kids now, for some of them, the only exposure they have to Samoan language is here in the church, is hearing the songs in Samoan, or getting some lines for the skit.
Tai learned to speak Samoan from his parents and grandparents. But Patsy Tito, the director of the Samoan Community Development Center in San Francisco, says not every family does that.
It's unfortunate that 2-3 generations from now, we might not have language because even, you know, our kids are having kids and they're speaking English to them.
There's also just a long history in the U.S. of non-English-speaking groups not being encouraged and often being strongly discouraged from speaking their home language. 5 years ago, when Tai's father Tala became pastor at the First Samoan Congregational Church in San Francisco, he realized that language gap was really affecting his congregation.
When we came here, we noticed that there are adults. And then I realized that most of them don't understand Samoan.
Pastor Tala decided that since so many people in the community couldn't understand when he preached in Samoan, he had to make a change. Now, the First Samoan Congregational Church holds services in Samoan and English to make everyone feel included. The pastor also thinks the bilingual services help English speakers understand a little more Samoan, too.
If I speak Samoan and then in English, then maybe they'll be able to reconciliate both languages and somehow learn a few words from this and that. That's how I learned English a lot at home. I went to a church where the sermon was interpreted. So I hear an English word, I don't know, I wait for the interpretation.
The church also offers bilingual choir, Sunday school, and cultural classes. Some families drive into the city from as far away as Vallejo and Vacaville to participate.
Don't forget, I told you. Raise your hand.
Before services start, Sunday school teacher Sala Toeahe wrangles her class of 8 and 9-year-olds into the church's chapel. Today's lesson is about Noah's Ark.
None of them speak Samoan, but they are learning. They are learning.
Okay, in English.
The rainbow in the sky.
That's why we're trying to do bilingual in our lessons at our Sunday school. I think they understand when we talk Samoan to them, but they cannot speak it. Samoan culture is very special to us, very precious. We have to keep that identity that we have, our Samoan identity, culture. We have to have them.
Salafolo Inoa Jaylene, Otisalmai, San Francisco.
8-year-old Jaylene introduces herself in Samoan while she constructs the Tower of Babel out of marshmallows in the church's daycare. Although she speaks English at home, Jaylene likes all the cultural activities they do at church.
I like that we always get to sing and it's really fun. I think it's good to speak in my language and it's fun learning more about my culture. Because at school we have cultural show and tell in my class. I do dances. I bring ia lava lavas, which is like something you put around your waist.
For Tai Fa'aleava, speaking Samoan is integral to his identity. But he says it's even disappearing in his own family.
Out of me and my siblings, I'm the only one that speaks it fluently. My siblings, my little brother has lost it completely. You know, I meet kids who were born here and never lived outside of here. You know, the way they identify with being Samoan is tattoos and long hair. That's it.
Tai sees these changes, but he doesn't think they're all bad. In many ways, he thinks that kind of evolution is inevitable.
Culture is like liquid, right? It's constantly evolving. I think as the generations continue, you know, culture is going to shift. The only thing that I would prefer is just to maintain the language.
Tai's dad, Pastor Tala, says the cultural activities and bilingual sermons have been really popular. And he says the kids are the ones pushing their parents out the door in the morning, anxious to be on time for those 9 a.m. classes. In San Francisco, I'm Sarah Harrison for Cross Currents.
Sarah is a summer intern here at KALW. She originally produced a version of that story as a graduate student at the UC Berkeley School of Journalism. And that's our show. Today's Cross Currents team includes Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Emma McAvoy, Lisa Morehouse, Nuria Marquez-Martinez, Truk Nguyen, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Marco Seiler-Gonzalez, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Listening to the harp and violin duo of Verdandia. They'll grace the Octopus Literary Salon in Oakland tomorrow night. Show starts at 5 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Treffy.